I'm Jim Haskell, editor of the Bridgewater Daily Observations, and today I'm coming to you from Singapore, where we are celebrating the 30th anniversary of a very special partnership between Bridgewater and GIC, the entity that is responsible for managing Singapore's international reserves. As part of this milestone, Bridgewater and GIC have engaged in a series of research projects to identify and assess the issues that we think are most important for investors to be grappling with in the years ahead. In fact, today we'll be sitting down, the two organizations, for the entire day reviewing the findings from that work. But we also thought it would be a great opportunity to do a video cast and share some of those highlights with all of you. And so joining me today from GIC is Group CIO Jeffrey Jane-Subakich, or otherwise known as Jeffrey J., as well as the CIO for Fixed Income and Multi-Asset, Liu Zumi, and from Bridgewater, co-CIO Greg Jensen. So I want to welcome all of you.
Thanks, Jim.
Our conversation today will focus on four major areas, three of which are in our joint research projects. They include, number one, U.S. exceptionalism. It's been a driving force in markets. So what produced that? Where are we today? And given the pricing, where are we likely to go in the future? The second will focus on artificial intelligence, or AI, and its impact on markets and economies. The third will examine China and the deflation that's emanating from China and look at the implications of that for investors. And the fourth is because we have Zumi here, and even though we didn't focus on sustainability in the joint research projects, we easily could have. And so we want to ask her, given her role as chair of GIC's Sustainability Committee, about the sustainable investing movement and where we are and where we're likely to go. So with that, let's get right into it. I want to start on the question of U.S. exceptionalism. This was an area that both organizations identified as a key issue for investors in the years ahead and something to grapple with. And Jeffrey, I want to turn to you first because the question is, what produced this U.S. exceptionalism? Where are we today? And do you believe it will continue? And I say that because so much of global portfolios are in the U.S., so that if it doesn't continue, that's a really big implication for markets and economies and so on.
Thanks, Jim. I think we should separate out economic performance versus markets performance. So U.S. economic performance has been really good, exceptional, but it's U.S. asset performance that has been truly exceptional. And particularly, you know, compared with everything else that, in dollar terms, it has been truly exceptional. So I think we should break these two up because I think the economic factors are ones that probably are structural and don't change. The U.S. has, you know, by resources and by size of the land mass and population, actually has a huge addressable market just domestically. And so companies and businesses that grow in the U.S. actually can grow to a huge size, achieve great economies of scale just in the domestic market without having to do anything internationally. The U.S. has, by tradition, also been a land of immigrants, which has brought in, you know, kind of a diverse population with its ability to create diverse new ideas and innovate. And that's definitely part of the U.S. exceptionalism that has translated into the economic performance through time as well. And I think on top of that, the system of government, policymaking, with its good checks and balances, with its responsiveness, I think, to you know, the population, to democratic calls for policy changes, the policy response has also been very reactive to what are changing needs as the economy has grown and developed and restructured through the years. I think all of those remain, and it's definitely one of the, you know, some of the key reasons why the U.S. has performed so well economically. There are, however, some other things that have really helped U.S. assets in the last few years. Some of those things are shared with other countries as well. So what are those? First is that interest rates have been falling for a long time, and that's been you know, kind of a big tailwind. That doesn't differentiate the U.S. necessarily. Taxes have been falling also for quite a while, and that has been shared by some of the other countries, but not necessarily by all. But that's a good tailwind also for the earnings growth that companies and assets get to see. And then the additional things are that US's innovation in the last 10 years particularly has been in areas where there are economies of scale and scope, network externalities, that US companies, because they were the first to develop some of these, were able to take market share, not only within, let's say, the technology sector, but also taking market share from retail, from advertising that otherwise would have gone, you know, to both domestic and foreign competitors. So I think the question for us as investors is to ask, you know, are these things that can continue going forward? But maybe I'll come to the last two thoughts that I have on that, which is that some of that exceptionalism is also cyclical. So one of the things that our joint research has shown is that valuations in the U.S. have really grown well beyond those of other countries and well beyond the fundamentals, the earnings growth and so on. And today, U.S. companies not only have earnings growth expectations that are well in excess of history, but well in excess of what other countries' earnings growth have as well. But in addition to that, there's still additional valuation premia that is given to the U.S., which, you know, is measured by the risk premia, if you will, on top of everything that has been priced in terms of growth. These things historically have been quite cyclical. And so you know, it would not be surprising to see some of the exceptional performance on the asset price level actually erode over the next decade or so. And you know, we're always told that if something, you know, achieves a market concentration, as the U.S. market is in the MSCI world, of 70%, you know, either competition or other cyclical factors will come in and you know, kind of turn that around. And I think we have to watch for that. The other piece of exceptionalism really is around the dollar, and the strengthening of the dollar, in some sense, works with asset prices to self-reinforce flows coming into the U.S. And as asset prices have done well, more foreign flows come in, domestic investors kind of return to the home market, and the dollar increases in value. Foreigners and domestics alike find that, oh, you know, it allows dollar measured performance to be even better, or you know, if you invest in the U.S., yen measured performance is even better, and that increases flows, increases valuation, increases performance. When that reverses, unfortunately, all of it reverses together as well. So I think those are you know, there are true fundamental exceptionalism that we see, market exceptionalism, but there are some cyclical stuff that I think could reverse.
Greg?
Well, Jeffrey shared so much, and we largely see it similarly, but just to add a little bit. So when we did the research with GIC, you could start the clock in a lot of different periods, but I think it's interesting to talk about the last 15 years, because you entered in 2009, coming out of the financial crisis. The markets weren't expecting the U.S. to particularly outperform. If you looked at expected earnings growth in Europe versus the U.S., et cetera, they were about the same. China, if anything, was priced to be exceptional. That period since 2009 has been this period of incredible exceptionalism, both in growth, although even more so, as Jeffrey said, in markets. That's kind of the backdrop. Now you pull that forward and you've got exactly, as Jeffrey said, now you've got this fully priced in, and actually the market is pricing in the next decade for U.S. companies to be better than the last 15. Last 15 years of exceptionalism was bigger than any other period in history over that time frame, and to expect that to continue is an extremely high hurdle. So we started in 2009 with no hurdle. U.S. companies outperforming as they did was a huge shock to markets, in a sense, that played out in the pricing. Now you have to outperform to get the same thing in pricing. You'd have to outperform by double, because what was that outperformance is already priced in. That's hard to do. And as you said, when you think about what it means to have 70% of the equity market in the world in U.S. equities, that means 70% of the money going into equity markets has to go into U.S. equities. Now, that could come from buybacks, that could come from the profits. So there's reason to believe that's not impossible. But it does mean that essentially to keep that up, 70% of the money has to keep going in. And for the, if they go to 75, then 75%. And you do know there's a cap at 100, I believe. and so there's a limit on that side to some degree. So those are issues. And the dollar, similarly, the dollar benefits. These things are intertwined. The dollar benefits from the equity market because global equity flows, mostly if people go into the benchmark, 70% of their dollars go into the U.S. That helps sustain a relatively big current account deficit. You take that and the desire essentially in the world to borrow in dollars to hold dollars because essentially it's the debt of the you know, the, it's what you need to save in to be able to pay your debts in the world. So you have that at a very high level and you're seeing it. The U.S. suffers from, you know, we call it a Dutch disease, but because technology is so concentrated in the U.S. and so much strength and that recycles this money, the rest of the industries in the U.S. can't really compete on the global stage. So the U.S. is also very concentrated in terms of global corporations where they can, where they, where we really have an edge because the dollar is so high, it's hard in other areas to compete. So those are challenges going forward. Where what you really need to reconcile the pricing in the U.S. is you need another, you need a compounding of the productivity difference, right? And it's possible. One of the benefits U.S. companies have is their profit margins. Those profit margins, so if you take the equity outperformance, revenue outperformed the rest of the world, that was about a third of the outperformance. Margins outperformed, that's another third. Two-thirds are revenues and profit margins. And the final third was valuations, right? So basically, if you stack up how equities outperformed in the U.S., it was an equal blend of more revenues because they outcompeted, better margins, which has to do with the nature of the companies, the productivity of those companies, but also a shift in the power between corporations and labor and a shift in taxes. And then the final thing is what Jeffrey described as cyclical, the valuation difference, which just makes the hurdle. It's to the extent it's right, it's pulled the returns forward. Like you've already got the returns the next decade if the U.S. continues to exceed already in the price. So that sets us up for a much more difficult decade, particularly in asset markets for the U.S. because the hurdle is so incredibly high.
Zumi, let me bring you in here now because we've heard Jeffrey, we've heard Greg talk about U.S. exceptionalism. And what they're really outlining is that the underlying fundamentals are there, but the pricing is going to make it very difficult to replicate this, you know, for the next decade as we've seen in the last decade. In terms of financial market returns. But there's an increasing question about a potential left tail outcome related to fiscal sustainability. And if we walk back in time, we know that the U.S. was highly, highly indebted, mostly in the private sector in the 2000s, the early 2000s. And of course, we had the global financial crisis. And since that time, because of a mix of policies, we've gotten this huge transfer from the private sector to the public sector, so such that today the private sector looks relatively healthy. And if you look at the government debt, particularly in the United States, that's at all-time highs. So I'm wondering how you think about that in terms of the sustainability of that and whether as an investor, you know, you worry about a left-tail type of outcome that would sort of change this dynamic of U.S. exceptionalism.
Definitely. I mean, fiscal sustainability is a key concern for the U.S. and frankly for some other countries too in the world. And if you look at the level of deficit we have today and the fact that if you look at the items and the spending, a lot of it is going to be baked in the cake in terms of not having enough flexibility for any governments that come in to change that. So you are almost looking at a level of deficit that will sustain for a period of time. So the question is, what are the politicians going to do in order to address this longer-term concern on fiscal sustainability? Now, obviously, there are different issues here. I think one is a time horizon issue. Today, the R-G in the U.S. is still negative. So it's not like an imminent problem, but at some point, they will get to a tipping point. So that's one. I think two is also on a relative basis. If you look at the U.S. state of the fiscal sustainability, but if you compare that to other countries, it may look like that actually it is not as bad as some of the countries in terms of the urgency of the issue. And then third, of course, if you're looking at an easing cycle that's coming up, you do have the ability for the U.S. to then issue bonds at a lower cost and maybe lengthen duration as well. So these are some of the tools and levers that at, you know, which the politicians, the government will need to think about in order to manage it for the longer term. But certainly, we believe that the term premium for long end of the U.S. bonds will need to go up to reflect that uncertainties around fiscal sustainability and around the issuance and supply concern for long end as well.
So the second topic we want to focus in is the artificial intelligence revolution, AI. And here we've had rapid advancements in capability and a lot of excitement about the potential for this technology. Also, some worries about constraints and things of that nature. We've had major outperformance in AI-themed stocks within the U.S. stock market and then leading the U.S. stock market relative to other stock markets in the world. And so is AI already impacting the real economy, or should we expect that it soon will be? And how do we see the arc of its development? And Greg, I want to start here with you. You are spending a lot of time on this subject and directly involved in many ways with this. How do you see the arc of AI and the impact it will have on markets and economies?
Yeah, it's an issue that I think is hugely important to get your hands around, and I've been thinking about it for a very long time. If you take AI in its current form, machine learning, like prior to that, let's say even coming to Bridgewater, one of the reasons I was excited to come to Bridgewater was I loved the idea of building systems and taking human intuition and programming that into code, which was obviously how Bridgewater is a big part of compounding our understanding over 45 years. Around 2012, I started getting super interested in this topic of when will machine learning actually be useful in the creative process? And I believe around 2022, the end of 2022, I thought the components had come together enough that machine learning could take the next leap in the world. And that's when we set up iLabs at Bridgewater to take the stuff we had been working on in small ways in machine learning, but to have 25 people fully focused on this, which gives us two windows into this, right? Window as chief investment officer looking down at saying, what's the productivity impact? How much investment there's going to be? All of those things. And then having our hands dirty, trying to build out machine learning to essentially determine what's next in the economy and what's next in markets. And, you know, from both of those windows, I think the bubble's ahead of us, not behind us. I know it seems like there's been a lot of priced in and there's a lot of euphoria around a lot of these things, but to me, the pieces are coming together in such a way that you can actually get higher quality decision-making, and that that's starting to happen, and that the people that are closest to it are investing massively and recognize it for the risk that it is to them. If they don't stay ahead, if you take a Google or whatever, if you don't stay ahead in AI, you're done for. And that's really right now only across a few companies that feel that way. I think as you go forward, like what the future will look like is many companies across many sectors will feel if they don't do that, they will fall behind. And that will radically change the investment thinking, right? And that people will pour money into how to replace their workers with AI agents and how to become super tremendously more productive down that path. So I think that we're only at the really early stages of this. And it's a little bit, there's a ton of stuff going on that's a little bit hidden because everybody's kind of looking at the language models and everybody knows their thoughts on ChatGPT and it does this dumb thing or whatever. And missing actually some people are not missing this, but the impact it's having on physical sciences, the impact that's going to have on healthcare, on vaccines, on those things are moving incredibly quickly. And so you look at where we are just over the last 3 years in terms of the impact, that growth rate is massive. So those are my big picture thoughts. Now, you could easily have an 18-month stumble along the way, and the biggest problems I see are that, A, it's easier to do destruction than production, and that there's a lot of the AI stuff that can be used for destructiveness, and I wouldn't be surprised at all. There's a massive regulatory risk. The DOJ, there's these investigations and there are these things. It's going to be very hard. I mean, we talked about U.S. exceptionalism, and it's not clear how tolerant the rest of the world is going to be to U.S. corporates taking another leg of share via AI. So it's very likely there will be reactions in other countries. The regulations will be different across countries about where you can and can't use it. So that's how I kind of see it at this point. As we turn back to the U.S. pricing, the only way the U.S. pricing can make sense, I think, in the end, is that you get a productivity miracle about twice the size of what you had in the last decade. And that's possible. I do think the fuel is there. The ability to make higher quality decisions at scale is huge. I think the power that is about to be unleashed in the world, which has many productivity possible benefits, ain't a lot of things to worry about as you go through it, because I think there will be lots of accidents along the way. So that's kind of my view of where it'll go.
Jeffrey, there's a lot to digest there from what Greg said. How are you seeing the AI arc and is in your position as group CIO at GIC? And how is it affecting the decision-making here at GIC?
Sure. Yeah, I think, in many ways, I agree with Greg that the future impact, the future adoption and use will be great, because the potential to improve your processes, out-earn what you're doing today, and out-compete will be huge, and everybody will eventually kind of need to adopt it. But I think, Greg's example of what Bridgewater is doing itself is illustrative of I think many of the issues that, as an investor in this trend, we have to think about, right? So today, what you have, let's say in the large language models, and there are 3 to 7 relevant ones, and so on, are tools that are being built that require a massive amount of investment to learn, to train the models, and so on. And it's already pulling in a lot of CapEx, whether it's buying of NVIDIA chips to allow the models to learn, the data centers that are needed to house them, the energy that's required to power it. The next question is, can these general models actually be used by themselves to improve productivity? Can they just be adopted and adjusted? Actually, they can't. So I think unlike, search models or social media, where the consumer or the company can just put it into the company and immediately you know how to use it, right? To be able to use large language models for the business applications that you want, as opposed to, asking them to write you a trip itinerary of Croatia or whatever, requires an ability of the company to adapt those models for its use. And if they're used quantitatively, those models by themselves are not good at handling numbers and math and mathematical concepts. So you need some know-how and ability to then convert that into the needs that you need for you want to fulfill for your own company. And so I think the next stage of investment, apart from these kind of purveyors of picks and shovels, will be, what are the companies that can differentiate themselves by being able to use the large language models and apply them specifically for their company's use? Even better, use proprietary data to really enhance the competitive edge that they get out of that. So I think what we will see is that there will be a stark differentiation between the companies that have that DNA, have already been using it, and will differentiate themselves positively, with all the others who won't, and who will struggle, because talent to hire in to do this is very scarce, will struggle maybe for years to be able to do that. So I think from an investor's point of view, we have to look for that differentiation. So every legal firm potentially could replace a lot of kind of associates, with AI. Those that can use it well, will initially be relatively few. Unless, and this is the second point, unless we see a proliferation of companies that adapt the large language models for the industry users that could really take advantage of this.
Zumi, let me turn to you on the question of China, which is the third big topic that our two organizations have done research on. And that is basically China was the success story of the global economy for many, many years. And the growth rate was very high. There was a lot of urbanization. All of that was a positive story. And then in the last few years, what we've seen after a period of, you know, overinvestment and high leverage is now stagnation. And in fact, even more pernicious, deflation that's emerging from the Chinese economy. So I want you, if you would, to start in and just tell us what the arc is of China. Where are we? Where are we likely to go? Is this going to be a worry for investors looking into the future?
Maybe let's take a step back and look at the perspective from history. China enjoyed a very exceptional period of growth rate, on average about 10.4% between year 2000 and 2010, in part thanks to this really fast and strong exports market share gain, especially post-WTO entry in 2001, but also because of very favorable demographic profile, as well as fast urbanization. But then the decade after that, and maybe just before COVID, you see that growth has also moderated, but it's still very impressive at 7.3% on average between 2011 and 2019. And thanks to the three traditional growth engine, so this would be exports, investments, and consumption, but also, like you said, rising leverage. So this rapid rise in leverage really increases the vulnerability for Chinese economy. So when it comes to COVID, when COVID hit in 2020, we see quite a remarkable adjustment to Chinese growth rate to now 4.7% between 2020 and 2023. Now, there are obviously a range of confluence of factors at play here, some cyclical, some structural, but both sets of drivers are really acting in the same direction at the same time on the Chinese economy. So let's start with the cyclical factors. One is this post-COVID recovery has been quite subdued, so that has knock-on impact on confidence, business confidence, but also on job availability as well as wage growth. So year-to-date till July, we have seen that personal income tax has declined by 5.5%. And that is after a minus 1% year-on-year in 2023. And based on the latest statistics that we saw, average wage growth in 38 major cities in China has decelerated from 2.2% in Q1 this year to now 0.5% in Q2. And this very soft, you know, aggregate demand has also led to increase in competition, especially in some industries. So we have seen, for example, companies having to bear very thin profit margin in order to squeeze out other players. There's a term for it in Chinese, actually. It's called 内卷, which I think the English translation is involution. So, for instance, the number of loss-making manufacturing companies has surged to something like 180,000 as of May of this year. And this is about 30% of total firms in China. And this number is double of what we saw in 2021. And there are some other cyclical factors as well, such as lower prices in pork, in commodities, and so on, that's acting as a deflationary pressure on a cyclical basis for the Chinese economy. But perhaps more importantly are the structural drivers. And these would include things like demographics. So we have passed the peak of favorable demographics in China. And there's also a profound shift in the Chinese economy model, as well as the accompanying priorities change in terms of policymakers trying to target now quality growth instead of quantity growth, as well as a policy-led structural adjustment and deleveraging in the system, especially in the real estate market. So take real estate, for example. The impact from deleveraging in the real estate in the economy is very significant. Real estate used to be something like 26% in terms of GDP share in 2020. Today, it's 17% as of 2023. And the property market also has very large knock-on impacts in terms of the credit chain. So, for example, in local government financing, in the consumption of and demand for commodities, as well as accounts for something like 60% of households' wealth in China. And this structural adjustment is going to take some time because it's very difficult to find something like a real estate contribution that can replace, in terms of growth engine for the Chinese economy in a short period of time. And this structural deleveraging in the real estate also coincided with a peak of population, decline in number of marriages in the system, in the country. And it also has coincided with a low level of urbanization rate as compared to the past, as well as elevated property prices to income and high household ownership as well. So all these would take time for us to be able to find a new growth model. And lastly, I think in terms of external pressure, we have rising geopolitical tension and talks on trade frictions and so on that will continue to exert pressure on the Chinese government to look for other ways to which they could think about national security and also the system self-sufficiency, so that in the next phase of growth, they will have to focus on some of these other things.
I think that paints the picture extremely well, right? When we look at this in our framework, right, you've got a long-term debt cycle problem for the private sector and for the state and local government in China. And deleveragings are hard. You have these choices to make, right? And right now, China's decision is more to tough it out, right? If you take the COVID, every other economy in the world, more or less, filled the gap. That there's a massive gap between, you basically close down the economy, and in China's case, for the longest also, you close down the economy, fixed costs keep running, and revenues drop. There's a big gap, right? When we went into COVID, I was calculating that gap across countries and said, like, it was a huge problem. I didn't know the fiscal response in the developed world would be large enough to more than fill that gap. That's been an interesting learning. But in China, they did it. And so on top of these problems we're building going into COVID, you had the problem of the massive leverage going into it. Now you take COVID, you get this incredible gap between the revenues go like essentially to zero and the costs keep building. And the way they chose to handle it in China was tell the banks you have to lend the money. But unlike the rest of the world, those debts were not forgiven. Those debts have just built up on those balance sheets. Banks are the mechanism through which kind of bad debt is managed. The defaults don't really happen. So you're stuck in this limbo of defaults happening at a very slow rate, basically not hardly. Banks forced to continue to kind of lend to companies that are losing money. And that circumstance keeps the ball rolling, but the problems don't get dealt with. Now, at the same time, there's some fundamental, really strong things about the Chinese economy. The central government could handle a lot more debt than it has, and they're choosing not to do that. So kind of two thoughts on that. I think when you look at the underlying strength in technology and the fact that the central bank right now is not, I mean, the central government is choosing not to do it. It's not that they can't do it. It's they're choosing not to do it. Those are powerful levers that still remain in play. And finally, on pricing, we talked about the U.S. China's the opposite. I mean, the market pricing is extremely depressed in terms of what's being expected. Now, be good reason for that because of the political challenges and whatever, but it is, by our measures anyway, an extremely high risk premium, a well-earned one at this point, but an extremely high risk premium that is pricing in negative earnings growth into the future compared to something like the U.S. where there's priced in exceptional earnings growth. And so those make interesting differences.
I want to add that there are different considerations for the government. So what are some of these? Number one, you must have regime and social stability. Number two, financial market stability. Number three, national security. And then fourth, economic growth. So I think above all, it's going to be a very tough balancing act because you have got so many different considerations and they're all acting at the same time in terms of some of these pressures. The broader picture is that we are coming to a very significant transformation of growth and economic model in China. And it requires a different lens to look at the state of the economy as well as how we invest in the market.
I want to turn to you, Jeffrey, with a question. In the joint work that we did, one of the interesting things there is that there's 21 case studies of deleveragings that are studied. And what you see there is that the distribution around the outcomes is very stark, right? If you're early and active and you're essentially monetizing away the debt, you may have some repercussions from currency, but you're going to have a better economic outcome. And if you wait too long the other way, then the concept, you know, the reality of deflation expectations starts to set in and can be highly damaging and very difficult to get out of without really radical policy. So, you know, sitting here, we see what's happening. As an investor, do you, you know, we've said, well, a balanced portfolio of bonds and stocks and other things is the best way to play that. And it's actually done quite well, even as this deleveraging has occurred. But as an investor in China, how do you see playing this situation, given that they're sort of going down this one track?
Right. I think the problem, if you will, for policymakers as well as for investors is pretty much the same one, which is trying to understand whether this is a stable equilibrium that, you know, the lower growth and all these, you know, deleveraging that's occur, can they still kind of hold it up here? Or in a semi-market economy or full market economy where you don't control everything, you definitely don't control the sentiment and therefore the economic consumption decisions that consumers make, is it an unstable equilibrium? Which means that once you don't arrest it early, as you put it on, actually you are already in this kind of vicious cycle that leads to a much worse outcome. I think, you know, if you look at history and so on, clearly it shows that the risk is actually on the left tail, right? Very fat left tail, lots of examples of this not being controllable. And I think the Chinese policymakers historically have looked at Japan and sort of said, we don't want to be Japan. And they're very worried about that. But this time, their policy response and so on seems very constrained, as Zumi described it. And I think as investors, as opposed to policymakers, you know, if we think that this is an unstable equilibrium that could lead to a vicious cycle, and I think that unfortunately is a very tough one. Doesn't mean that there isn't a range of things that an investor can do in China. You can build a very nice balanced portfolio. And I think for long-only asset owners, it's a very different problem, right? And I think it's one where you sort of say, well, I can own Chinese bonds and I start at a low bond yield and I'll get some capital gains. But if I keep investing there, I'll just get that low bond yield, right? So the question is that what you want? On an equities perspective, I think there is a difference between investing in an aggregate index that gives you the whole economy and therefore all the problems that comes with managing an economy and deleveraging versus looking for companies that can still perform well in absolutely in an environment like this. And so there are opportunities, whether in private equity going in and taking control of a company or looking for the companies where they've really decided to govern themselves, corporate governance-wise, govern themselves well, where you can really translate what is still decent revenue growth, maybe they're even gaining market share, into earnings per share growth.
For our last question, we want to focus in on sustainability. You know, over the last decade or so, there's been a real significant movement for investors to look beyond just risk and return and also include sustainability as part of their investing paradigm. And that includes both GIC and Bridgewater. But with you here, because you're the current chair of GIC's Sustainability Committee, I'd like to ask you about GIC's approach to sustainability.
I think before we talk about the approach, it may be useful to sort of take a step back. It's useful to explain the three core beliefs or philosophy, if you will, that really govern and anchor the way we think about what we do on sustainability. First is that we believe companies with sustainability practices or good sustainability practices will achieve better risk return over the long run. And reason is simple. We think that the rules and norms of how society is operating changing very fast in terms of policies, regulations, consumer preferences, business operations, and so on and so forth. So we think that for companies to be profitable in the future, they must be sustainable. So that's a key belief. Second is that it's important for us to take a long-term and holistic approach towards sustainability. Now, we operate in many countries and many industries across the world, and we find that there may be sometimes some of this, trade-offs between different sustainability objectives, especially between the E and the S in, say, emerging markets. So for long-term investors like ourselves, it's important that we integrate sustainability considerations in the way that recognizes the idiosyncrasies and also the diversity of the markets and industries in which we operate, the trade-off that's needed, the time that's needed in order for this transition to take place. So we think that a much more bottom-up, much more nuanced approach towards sustainability is much more effective in helping companies in the transition pathway rather than sort of top-down, one-size-fits-all approach where you may divest, you know, in the whole of industry, for example. So that's the second thing. And then the final thing, which we believe is actually very important, is that we want to be able to contribute to decarbonization in the real world. So the focus is on the impact on what we do on real-world decarbonization as opposed to focusing on portfolio decarbonization, because the latter can be, frankly, achieved by portfolio engineering, divestment, and you name it, right? But we think that by doing so, it may not necessarily be constructive to what's happening to the real economy. So that's the third key pillar for us to then think about, okay, what we should do on sustainability in order to sort of meet, you know, some of our key objectives here. And in terms of the approach, okay, maybe let's again sort of look at the world in terms of sustainability spectrum. So if you put all the assets in the world along sustainability spectrum, on one hand, you have sustainable assets or green assets. On the other hand, you have stranded assets or assets that has high risk of being stranded because they may be very high carbon intensity. And then everything in the middle is what we call transition. And if you use MSCI All Country Index as sort of a proxy for global investment universe, then you find that the green bucket has about 7% of asset today. The left-hand side, which is your stranded asset or high carbon, you know, intensity bucket, that's about 10%. But by the way, they are responsible for something like 40% of the whole index, WACI, or weighted average carbon intensity. And then everything in the middle, which is the bulk of it, is 83%, and that's called transition. So for us, our approach is to recognize that the companies in each of these three buckets have got distinct capital needs, have got very distinct transition plans and trajectory. So for us, the approach is quite differentiated. Conceptually, what we want to do is that for the green bucket, we want to put in capital to help scale up some of these decarbonization solutions. So things like some of this green fuel, green hydrogen, EV charging, you know, infrastructure, green steel, carbon capture, and so on. So the whole range of decarbonization solutions technology that requires a lot of capital to scale up and to commercialize. So that's one end. The other end is to say that, okay, do we have a viable alternative or do we have a pathway for transition? If the companies do not want to, transition or do not have any ability to do so, we will choose to divest from them. And this is one way of managing the stranded risks in our portfolio as well. And then finally, in the middle bucket, it's the transition bucket, which is where the bulk of the work is because we have the largest amount of assets in this bucket. And unfortunately, the work is quite complex because it's very nuanced. There's so many different types of companies, industries in different parts of the world. And the rate of decarbonization and transition depends a lot on things like where you are in terms of geography, what industry you come from, the type of technology that's available for the transition, the economics of it, and then, of course, policies and regulations. So what we want to do conceptually is to look at different situations and then ask ourselves, does it make sense for us to then help these companies in terms of the transition pathway, in terms of transition capital, when it makes sense in terms of risk-reward, active engagement to understand what are the different levers they can pull in order to decarbonize the operations. And then also in terms of our ability to look at our proxy voting process and to vote responsibly.
So with that, let's bring this conversation to a close. I just want to say what an honor it's been on this anniversary, our 30th anniversary, to be with all of you. Jeffrey, Zumi, Greg, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, that was great.